Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the Civil War. And here's the question that we will consider and discuss in this part of the show. Was the war avoidable? Very specifically, could Abraham Lincoln have avoided the Civil War? I think probably if you think back to the time that you've done in history during your school years, you will recall that the way we were taught about the war was that it had a certain kind of inevitability. And in fact, even Abraham Lincoln himself said he felt that war had been thrust upon him, not something that he chose to do. This morning in this part of the show, we have a rather contrarian view of this question. And our guest is William Marvel. He's the author of a number of books about the Civil War, including Lee's Last Retreat, A Place Called Appomattox, Andersonville, and half a dozen other books on the war. He has a new one that's titled Mr. Lincoln Goes to War, and it is published by Houghton Mifflin, in which he makes the argument that, in fact, the war could have been avoided, and presents a rather different view of Abraham Lincoln than the one that we often get. So as we talk this morning in this part of the show, certainly questions are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing that we ask of callers is that they are try to be brief and keep their questions short so that we can get in as many different people as possible, keep things moving along. But of course, the idea is here that if people are listening and have questions, they can call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois and Indiana. Also, in fact, any place in the country you might be listening on the internet, you can also use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Locally, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Marvel, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
We certainly appreciate it. One of the points that I think you make has to do with the way that we think about Abraham Lincoln and the fact that to attribute to him motives anything less than honorable is just not on, or at least that's not the way that we have been taught. And in fact, I think you've said something to the effect of it's maybe he is one of the least well-examined figures in the Civil War, or at least perhaps the last one that anyone got to looking at in this way. So maybe we might begin by raising that question or having you talk about that. Why is it that it seems that no one really wants to think badly of Mr. Lincoln? Almost no one.
Well, I suspect that the person most responsible for that is John Wilkes Booth. Whenever a president is assassinated, as those of us who remember the Kennedy assassination can attest, there is a process of deification, and that was particularly true in the case of Lincoln because of the crisis that the nation had so recently endured and escaped from, ultimately, just as he was killed. It's true, I think, that his largely positive perception is almost unrevised today. There have been a number of people with particular viewpoints, libertarians, for instance, who have begun recently to assail his actions and his motives. But in general, the mainstream historian has tended to accept a generally flattering view. And I don't think that there's necessarily any reason to believe that there's anything devious or evil about his intent. He probably had the best intentions as he made his decisions in confused and desperate situations, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he made the best decisions.
Well, and I think one of the things that you do argue is that Abraham Lincoln probably didn't, maybe probably is not the word, he didn't count on the war going the way that it did being as destructive as it was, as going on as long as it did, as many people dying as it did, and that perhaps if he had known, that he might have done things differently.
Well, he did remark at least once that that if the coalition against him became too powerful to surmount, that it would be time to give up the fight. And I suspect, had he known just how devastating it would be, he might have chosen, if not to give up the fight, at least to seek another solution to the problem. No one really expected the war to last very long, and even if it did, I don't think anyone anticipated the mortality that it would entail. There were too many factors that weren't even understood by the time the war was over, about the effects of disease on vast congregations of people, and the effects of modernization in armament that people didn't think of until 20 or 30 years later, when they began reflecting on the comparisons between their own time and that time.
Certainly one way to have avoided the war, although it might have been the most extreme, would be simply to have let the southern states go. Something that apparently at the time, even within the Republican Party, there were some people who would have said, fine, we'll do that. Now, that's something that Abraham Lincoln would not have accepted. For him, keeping the Union together was the most important thing. How much discussion was there of that very thing, just to say, if the southern states want to succeed, let them go. We can live with that.
That opinion was a lot more prevalent than most people realize. In fact, in the days and weeks just before Fort Sumter, a lot of newspapers, including Republican newspapers, the Hartford Courant, for instance, in Connecticut, and the State Journal in Lincoln's own hometown of Springfield, Illinois, and the New York Times were commenting not only that it was time to let the South go, but that was the prevailing opinion. That seemed to be a majority opinion. I think the Courant, at least, made that observation, that it was a majority opinion, that it was time to acknowledge secession. Also, that it was the least costly and potentially least destructive solution to the problem. And although there were other options that Lincoln could have pursued, and still at least nominally followed his obsession with keeping the Union together, it's probably true that the real alternative that he had was acknowledging secession. And it seems to me that it was more of a personal stubbornness than a matter of political will, although we have been led to believe that it was it would have been the destruction of the Republican Party, and that he had therefore a political imperative to refuse to acknowledge secession. I don't think that was true, just from reading the editorials of the time.
As you mentioned, that Lincoln and probably a lot of other people did not really anticipate, didn't understand how far the war would go and how destructive it would be. Even after the first shots were fired at Fort Sumter, there would have been a possibility to avert the full war. The war hadn't really started.
That's true.
Didn't really start quite yet. So, again, going back to this issue of nobody really knew what was going to happen. Even after Fort Sumter, and at the time that Lincoln was actually using this to encourage people to sign up, now troops were starting to be raised, and this outrage that was a result of the attack was roaring through the North, and people were really galvanized. Even at that point, it was not certain at that point that it would have gone on to be the war that we had. So then the question is, even after Fort Sumter, what did Lincoln think was going to happen?
I suspect that he viewed a previous incident, the Star of the West incident in January of 61, as as the result he would have of his effort to resupply Fort Sumter. A supply ship had been sent down to Sumter when South Carolina was virtually alone. The Confederacy had not yet been formalized, and South Carolina troops fired on that ship, and there was an outcry across the nation, and people of different political persuasions suddenly were unified and ready to, I think, take arms against South Carolina, at least. And I can't believe that Lincoln didn't remember that. And so he probably anticipated that. He ultimately admitted later that even though the expedition was a failure, he had expected it to further the national cause, that is, the issue of nationalism, even if it failed. And so he admitted that he was happy with the result. He was using that to, as you say, galvanize public opinion. And he called for troops, which I suppose he thought would be viewed as a show of strength. And instead, it was viewed as probably a violation of his promise not to invade the southern states. And it ended up costing him four more big southern states that seceded and joined the Confederacy. At that point, he had basically shown his hand, and all he could either do was surrender or undertake military action, and ultimately he did. There was a period of a few weeks where there were some clandestine negotiations with no real hope of any solution, but he had essentially committed himself to the sword.
Yeah. Well, this crisis involving Fort Sumter was virtually the first thing that he had to deal with after becoming president. This was a matter of days after becoming president.
It was actually his first hour, what I would call his first office hour as president,
yeah,
the morning after he was inaugurated.
And at the time, I think that in the South, there only were a couple of federal forts left. Sumter was one of them. Maybe there were only two.
There were several.
And so one could argue that there, again, this is another one of those what if questions or why did he do what he did questions. He knew that the fort was threatened, that the troops there, they needed supplies, and I guess the question is, why not just let it go? Why not just pull those troops out of there and remove the opportunity for conflict at that point? I mean, given the fact that it was early on, given the fact that it was, as you say, it was virtually his first hour as president, given the fact that there were so many uncertainties, why not just avoid the possibility for conflict right at that moment? Why was Fort Sumter so important?
Well, he had promised the day before he learned of the vulnerability of the fort to hold the southern forts in the vein of promising not to invade the southern states, but merely to deliver the mails if they would be accepted and to hold the forts. There were at least three other forts that were as yet untaken by the Confederates. There was Fort Pickens at Pensacola, Fort Taylor at Key West, and Fort Jefferson on Dry Tortugas off the coast of Florida, off the tip. And those last three were eminently defensible. Dry Tortugas would have required a Confederate Navy, and there was no Confederate Navy to capture. And the same was true of Fort Taylor on Key West, and nearly so of Fort Pickens in Pensacola. Fort Sumter was the most vulnerable of the forts because by March of 61, it was being surrounded by Confederate batteries. That was what Lincoln learned on the morning of March 5th. And it seems undeniable to me that the attraction of Fort Sumter to him was its very vulnerability, because it had the capacity of creating a confrontation, and perhaps, if not a bloody one, at least a violent one that would somehow cut the Gordian knot of the political impasse.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is William Marvel. He's the author of a number of books about the Civil War. His most recent is Mr. Lincoln Goes to War. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. It looks at this question of, was the war inevitable? Could Abraham Lincoln have avoided it? And he provides an answer that's a little bit different than that perhaps that we have heard when we have studied or read about the Civil War. Questions here on the program are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. How much of Lincoln's thinking do you think had to do with this difficult dynamic that he had with his cabinet, that seemed that we're fighting as much with each other as we were fighting in the country at the time? It was this very difficult sort of relationship he had with them, and how much of what he did might actually be attributed to his wanting to demonstrate to them, to his cabinet members, that he was the president, he was in control, and he was going to make his decisions, and if they didn't like it, that was too bad.
Well, the month of March was a period of transformation for his cabinet. Early in the month, he convened the cabinet to ask about supplying Fort Sumter, and the response was largely negative. It was thought to be too provocative by most. One cabinet member who was adamant that the fort should be held, though, was the Postmaster General Montgomery Blair, who, ironically enough, was a Democrat. I find that at that period, it was mostly the Douglas Democrats who were the most stubborn about holding the country together and resisting secession. And Blair, being one of those, and being the son of a member of Jackson's kitchen cabinet, Andrew Jackson's, he and his father visited Lincoln, and the Postmaster General was about ready to resign only a few weeks into the administration because of Lincoln's apparent willingness to let Fort Sumter go. But still, for a few weeks, Lincoln did nothing about it. It wasn't until March 28th that he seems to have made at least a tentative decision to resupply the fort. And it was also on March 28th that the U.S. Senate adjourned from a special session. It was the last House of Congress still in session. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the Senate adjourned and he made his decision to go ahead with the confrontation at Fort Sumter on the same day, because suddenly he could act somewhat unilaterally. He did have his cabinet members to think of, but by the time the expedition sailed, he had already established himself, at least with his Secretary of State, William Seward, who had been sort of hoping to be the effective prime minister. Lincoln had had a discussion with him about the responsibilities of the executive versus the Secretary of State, and he had made it clear that he was the president, not Seward. But the cabinet, in my opinion at least, and this may not be the opinion of Ms. Goodwin, was somewhat incidental to the Fort Sumter decision-making process. Lincoln was happy to have their assent, and he finally did get the cabinet's assent for to send the expedition to Fort Sumter, but I believe that he was making his decision from his own personal viewpoint and merely trying to get the cabinet in line at that point. He had not effectively learned who all the members of his cabinet were yet.
Was he, just again, one more really basic question, was Lincoln inviting the attack? Did he not only expect that it would be attacked, but did he want it actually to be attacked?
Well, over the decades, there's been a divergent opinion on that point. As early as 1937, there was a professor who charged in an article in the Journal of Southern History that Lincoln had basically started the war by sending the expedition to Sumter because he knew it would create a violent confrontation. And in fact, he did send emissaries to Charleston, friends of his from the Illinois legislature who had their own Southern origins. One of them was a native of Charleston. They talked to people in South Carolina and came back and reported essentially that even an attempt, a peaceful attempt to send food, Fort Sumter would be responded to violently. So he had the intelligence, as we would say today, to know that his actions would lead to a fight. There are others who have claimed that he merely was willing to take the risk of war in order to establish federal authority in Charleston. But it seems to me that that's a somewhat specious argument, because his information was so positive, leading to the conclusion that there would be gunfire, that he must have expected it.
We have some callers. Why don't we talk with them, bring them into the conversation.
Sure.
Here in, both of them from Urbana, and we'll start with line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, yes. Well, I guess I'm just curious about this. I came in a little late, so do you have a book? Or?
Yes. That's the, I suppose, the impetus for this interview.
Sure.
Mr. Lincoln Goes to War. It came out a few weeks ago.
Mr. Lincoln Goes to War. Okay. I'm sorry, what's your name?
I'm Bill Marvel.
Okay, I guess the question I have, and you know, I find this fascinating, I hadn't really thought about it too awful much, is, you know, should Lincoln have allowed secession? You know, I'm kind of correlating things with what's happened with the Soviet Union and the breakup of the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
and basically the chaos that's going on there. This being, you know, the United States, a singular continent, I'm just wondering, would it not have eventually become inevitable for gunfire, basically? Because I just, knowing the way, you know, at least the way I perceive people and the way I perceive the tone of today, I can imagine it was, you know, possibly even more heated going into, you know, discussions over slavery and stuff like that. I imagine that, I just don't know if secession and then the North setting, you know, tariffs or sanctions or whatever against the South, because I assume the North would be a richer state at that point than the South would have been. Do you think that pressure from the North would have eventually abated slavery, or do you think diplomacy would have? Or I just don't.
Do you mean in if secession
had
been acknowledged in 61?
Well, I mean, had been acknowledged by the president, and
yes.
The South had been allowed to secede without a first shot being fired.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the instinctive question, of course, what would have happened. And it's repugnant for a lot of people today to even consider, because the absence of a cohesive United States is unthinkable to many people. And there's really the idea of compounding circumstances is so influential on history that it's impossible to say what would have happened.
Well, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Cut you off. I guess what I was more thinking is that, you know, having slavery within the borders of the United States today, mm-hmm. would be more unthinkable, I think, than a cohesive
yes.
United States.
Well, today, of course, the slavery is the issue, and
sure.
At least when you're talking about the Civil War, but it became the issue later on, even though it was the underlying political conflict of secession. It was the breakup of the Union that was the most heated and emotional issue in 1861. Although slavery was important to a minority, a small minority of Americans most Americans at that time were more concerned about losing the Union.
Right.
And that has reversed today. I mean, for you and me, the question should be, well, how long would have slavery have lasted had the South seceded? And I guess that is your question.
Yeah, basically.
It's hard to speculate on that sort of thing, but we had at least nominal emancipation in 1863. We had statutory emancipation in 1865, but it was still another full century before black people in America saw any real freedom.
Before they could vote in the 1960s.
Well, so. Frequent whatever establishments they wanted to, and that was a full century, and it took another small war of sorts in the 1960s,
sure.
50s and 60s to achieve that. The question then becomes: would slavery have ended within that century in an independent Confederacy?
Right. I suppose it's how far back would we still be compared to today? I mean,
And while that's impossible to answer, you have to consider that there were other nations that subsequently abolished slavery within their borders peacefully after the Civil War. Brazil and Cuba, to name two, were able to achieve emancipation without war. And according to Arthur Schlesinger, the reason that they were able to do so is because it was a national problem. It affected the entire country, and it suppressed free enterprise throughout the country. That wasn't true in the United States. Therefore, you had a conflict between regions. The South was able to use the North as a vent for that of its population that wanted to seek a life in free enterprise, and was at the same time able to maintain its slave economy, and that's what was found to be so difficult in other countries where it was abolished. So, taking Mr. Schlesinger's notion a step further, if the South had become an independent nation, it's quite possible that the problems that slavery caused would have created internal pressure to abolish it somehow. And if that were not the case, it seems to me that the increasing unpopularity of slavery globally would have caused an external pressure not unlike that which South Africa endured some years ago because of its apartheid policies.
I have one quick question. I know you've got other callers and I need to get off, but I just was curious. Are there any correlations, basically, between what happened with the Soviet Union? Because when you look at what's happened in the Soviet Union since the breakup of the Berlin Wall, there's been lots of small countries split off from the Soviet Union, a lot of factions within the countries fighting amongst themselves. You know, I'm wondering if the South had split off, would there have been factions within the South? Do you think fighting amongst themselves about slavery, about religious views?
Well, the South at that point was sufficiently repressive of anti-slavery views that it would have been difficult, had it become independent, for those views to be voiced. It was sufficiently difficult within the states where slavery existed in the 1850s and 60s.
So if you lived there, you'd better pack up and get out.
Well, that's what Hinton Rowan Helper thought. He left North Carolina in order to write a book called The Impending Crisis of the South about the economic impact of slavery. He was persona non grata in the South thereafter, and of course there was statutory sanction for anyone who espoused anti-slavery views publicly in many states. The greater concern that would parallel your reference to the Soviet Union was that allowing the South to secede would make secession an acceptable alternative for future conflicts. And Lincoln himself alluded to the possibility of other sections of the country seceding because they saw different interests. And there was even a rumored and perhaps in some corners hoped for secession of the old Northwest Territory to ally itself with the South because of the common corridor of the Mississippi River. And it's quite possible that that sort of what we would today call balkanization would be possible, but you also have to ask yourself whether that would have been necessarily bad. The Soviet Union, you remember, was held together largely by force, and the factions that have surfaced in the different elements of the old Soviet Union were simply repressed probably by military authority. There were no such violent confrontations in the United States at that time other than the slavery free state issue, except perhaps the expulsion of the inhabitants of the plains.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We are a bit past the midpoint here. I should introduce again a guest for this hour. We are talking with William Marvel. He has written a number of books about the Civil War, including Lee's Last Retreat, A Place Called Appomattox and Andersonville, a half a dozen others. He's won a number of awards for his books. And the most recent is a book that takes a look at the, roughly speaking, the first year of Abraham Lincoln's presidency, the year 1861. The title of the book is Mr. Lincoln Goes to War. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, and it looks at this question that we've been talking about here this morning on the program. The question being, was the Civil War inevitable, or could Abraham Lincoln have prevented the war? Questions are welcome. We have a couple of others who are ready and waiting to go. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. That's the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line if you'd like to call in, and that's 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana and line two. Hello.
Mr. Marvel.
Yes.
Just recently read Lincoln at Cooper Union, and also Johansson's biography of Stephen Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that for the impetus of the war itself, you're leaving out the secessionist firebrands in the deep southern states who had been listening to politicians going back through the long career of John C. Calhoun.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to not only protect their southern institutions, namely slavery, and extend it into the territories where new states were being created out of the Louisiana Purchase.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, they wanted even more restrictive fugitive slave laws than the one passed in 1850, and had plenty of journalistic support in whipping up their population to start secession and a war with the national government. Now, what do you say in response to that?
I say that, well, what you say is entirely true. I am trying to examine and judge Lincoln by his own actions, not by the actions of others. And he had opportunities for other responses to those actions. Obviously, the secession itself is as responsible, if not more so, for the war than Lincoln himself. But he is the central character whom everyone looks to as the perfect figure who never failed in his or at least never failed conspicuously in his presidency. And
I just don't think he had as much to do with it as you are promoting.
What if he had not sent a relief expedition to Fort Sumter?
I think that is such a small action that it would have done nothing. I think the momentum in the South was building fast, and when border states had the chance to make the choice, they chose the regional view rather than the national view, and seceded also. This is a,
well, that's not
this,
quite
this
correct.
View, this is the view from Johansson.
Mm-hmm. If you look at the states of Missouri and Virginia, for instance, both of them had secession conventions. Both of those conventions voted overwhelmingly to stick with the Union, not to join the Confederacy. It wasn't until after Fort Sumter after Lincoln called for troops that those states, that Virginia seceded. And even at that point, Missouri did not. The confrontation at Fort Sumter was, for its day, at least as provocative as the attack on Pearl Harbor, so I hardly could call it insignificant.
The attack was from the South.
Yes, it was.
They started the shooting.
That's true, but if the relief expedition had not been sent to Fort Sumter, if instead Lincoln, for instance, had opted to make his stand on the coastal forts of Florida, where he was in a much better position to defend those forts, then there probably would have been no confrontation, at least of the magnitude of Fort Sumter.
I just don't buy it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Do you want to finish that thought, or should we just go on to
The caller actually made some other points that I would have liked to have talked about, mm-hmm. such as the issue of slavery in the territories and the fugitive slave laws. And frankly, if the South had seceded, the issue of slavery in the territories, which was the overriding cause of the conflict at that point, slavery in the territories, it would have disappeared. Now, that's not to say that the Confederate states would not have tried to create their own confrontation or try to actually wrest some of those territories from federal authorities, but at least theoretically, the issue would have been moot at that point. The fugitive slave laws, which were so anathema to northern abolitionists, would no longer have been enforceable if the South had seceded. So those are factors that would have been ameliorated by secession. Not to say that I'm advocating that secession would have been the solution, but I don't believe that the advantages of that solution have been adequately investigated.
All right, let's talk with someone else. This is also in an Urbana caller, line 3. Hello.
Yeah, I was wondering if, after what you just said, if under secession, if we could have avoided war even after that, because we tend to get very insecure about people close to us taking different tacks. So I'm not sure secession would ever have been a final answer. But I wanted to bring up how reluctant Lincoln was to get into approve the Mexican War, for example,
mm-hmm.
and how he went on the floor of the House and demanded to know where American blood had been shed. And
the spot resolution.
Yeah, I wanted to point something else out that quite unlike the present situation, it was Abraham Lincoln that brought up the or imposed the estate tax, taxing the wealthy to pay for war. The exact opposite of what this president is doing, relieving the burden on the wealthy. But my main question is, I was just curious as to whether you could point to anything in his presidency that shows how he might handle a different situation where there was this unreconcilable difference in play, you know, where there really could not be a compromise. And I was curious if there had been anything that you might point to that we might be able to read something out of it as to how he might have, I mean, what his attitude was about that kind of a situation, other than war. And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, unfortunately, Lincoln's administration was dominated by war. And he did have at least that one opportunity to back down against Great Britain over the Trent affair, and that was that to my mind was an admirable decision. But whether he did that because he already was involved in a war with the South, or whether he simply recognized that the action of his naval officers was illegal and arrogant and deserved an apology, I don't know. But that would be a good example, I suppose, of how he might have chosen a more peaceful solution. I know in the troubles with the Santee in Minnesota, he reacted militarily rather than to try to solve the problems of the Indian Bureau in the Interior Department. But of course, that would have been a long process that he didn't live long enough to complete and was too busy to undertake. The reference to his taxation raises another issue, though. It may be that he imposed the estate tax, but there was also an income tax that was imposed. But the tax that really hurt most Americans was the tax on property, local property, that resulted from the effort to raise bounties, which in turn were raised to try to lure volunteers. Right here in New Hampshire, soldiers who enlisted in 1861 or early in 1862 received no local bounties or only nominal local bounties of $10 or so. By the end of the war, towns were spending $600, $700, $800, $1,000 just to attract volunteers to fill their quota under the War Department draft. And those bounties were paid for through taxation. So the soldiers who went to war in 1861, who survived and came home, found their taxes almost exactly 10 times what they had been, at least here in New Hampshire, when they went to war. And that was a significant burden. The burden of the Civil War, as with most others, was proportionately worse on the poor, and the estate tax notwithstanding.
All right, let's take another caller. This is, Normal, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've got a couple of things. One is my grandmother, who's in her 90s, remembers her great-grandpa when she was a girl, mm-hmm. telling stories about the Civil War, mm-hmm. that he fought for Michigan. And she said that they all thought he was rich because his pension was $60 a month as a Civil War veteran. Mm-hmm. I'd be curious to know how you can research, getting confirmation of stories you hear like this. Where can a guy go? And then the second question I have deals with the moral trend of the North before the Civil War broke out. Has anyone looked at this? One of my theories I wonder about, the moral conviction that the North had about slavery deepened as the Second Great Awakening spread. And there's, from what I've read, there's some connection with, not a direct one or an overt one, but some sort of friendship between the Second Great Awakening in the North, especially in New York, and the abolitionist movement in the North. What do you think of that? Have you looked at that? And did that help the North say, hey, this is really, really wrong, we do need to do something about it, instead of kind of looking the other way?
Well, in answer to your first question, you've really touched on what I've discovered, what I've learned most about after 30 years or more of studying Civil War history, and focusing on that period in particular. You cannot rely on memoirs and recollections, verbal or otherwise. It's the golden rule of history, so far as I'm concerned, and that's why I turn almost exclusively to contemporary documents and diaries and letters, because those people who remembered the war one way, whether they remembered it sincerely in that way, or whether they remembered it artificially for the benefit of their image or for the entertainment of their audience, it's almost always a different war from that which they experienced, and you can tell that by comparing their published memoirs with diaries of the same people. It's happened to me numerous times.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to research whether your ancestors' pension is what your grandmother said it was, and it could have been if you lived long enough, $60 a month, you can always go to the National Archives and look up his military and pension records.
Mm-hmm.
And it will tell you how much he got and when and for what reasons. Oftentimes the reasons for a pension are perfectly ludicrous. I've known of soldiers who were pensioned for having been moonstruck, which means at least in those days was supposed to mean having been affected by the moon while sleeping on the ground at night. and that sort of chicanery was fairly common in the pension department. Obviously there were a lot of disabled veterans who not only deserved what they got but needed more, but probably for each of them there was at least one other who was basically playing the game. And in fact the last dozen or so reputed Civil War veterans turned out to have been fakes who were either not old enough to have fought and to even remember the war, or had simply not been in service at all, or in some cases not even in this country at the time. But they applied for pensions within the southern states, and those pensions were granted.
I'm pretty sure that he actually fought for Michigan, because the whole family's from Michigan. And
I'm sure a northern account is much more likely to be true than not, because it was so much more easily corroborated. The records were
that shows me how to check it out, though, and I appreciate that. What about the Second Great Awakening question?
Well,
guys like Charles Finney, who were reporting to have massive influence in New York City, mm-hmm. and other places in the 30s, 40s, and 50s leading up to this, toughening up the moral fiber of the North. What do you think of that theory?
Well, I haven't heard that specific theory, but obviously religious conviction played a large part, especially among Quakers, in abolitionist activity. But you have to remember that even with that influence that you speak of, abolitionists in the North were a distinct minority. Even many of the Harvard-educated officers in Massachusetts regiments whose parents were involved in the abolitionist movement were antagonistic toward it. They viewed abolitionists and slaveholders as equally responsible for having inflamed the conflict to the point of war. Among soldiers, at least, there was very little abolitionist sentiment. So to say that impelled the North to an abolitionist viewpoint is taking it a little too far, but it's fairly certain that their religious convictions played a large part in individual decisions.
We are just about out of time. There's a lot that we haven't gotten to. One major theme that you deal with the book is Lincoln and his attitude toward presidential power, which is a very hotly debated question right now. Just maybe for you can take just a minute to talk about something else. And the question is raised in my mind by the comment from the listener about the soldier's pension, that some people argue that the fact that so many people rallied to the call to arms in the North says something about people's support for the idea of union and against secession. I think, though, you make the argument that, in fact, at least some of these people, the reason they responded to the call was economic reasons.
Well, I'll answer the first, your second reference first. I found that a significant number, perhaps not a majority, but certainly a plurality of men who enlisted, even at the very outset in 1861, were either unemployed or underemployed or destitute. And I discovered that when I began to notice how many shoemakers there were in Massachusetts regiments. And shoemaking was a large business industry in northeastern Massachusetts. About 4% of the population, the working population of Massachusetts, consisted of shoemakers. But they were also the poorest tradesmen in the state. They had mounted the largest single labor action before the Civil War, just a year before the Civil War. And they had failed in their action because they were so poor they couldn't afford to survive a strike. And even though they composed only 4% of the working population, I found that in some Massachusetts regiments, shoemakers composed 25 or 30, and in one case 36% of the regiments that went to war, and that indicates to me that they were looking at the $13 a month and perhaps a $10 bounty and perhaps the community's promise to pay their families $5 or $7 a month in support. They were looking at that as a significant subsistence pay.
Yeah. Pardon me for jumping in on you there, but I simply must, because I'm sorry to say we've used our time and we're going to have to stop. More, of course, to be found in the book that we've talked about, Mr. Lincoln Goes to War, by our guest William Marvel.